Now then, witches and beautiful souls, you are listening to the Bell Witch Podcast, Witching in the 21st Century with me, Swales, the Friendly Green Witch. As you can tell, my voice ain't sounding so good. At the moment, I am suffering with this cough and cold from hell, and it's a bane of a podcaster's life, because when you're a solo host, you've only got your one voice to go on. So I've been putting it off, and I can't put it off any longer. And so I thought I'd just do just a teeny tiny intro to welcome you on to this fabulous episode, which is 28. And to introduce what we're going to talk about in this lovely episode, all my other news will just have to wait until my voice is better. In this episode, I have a lovely guest talk about archaeology, folklore, digging adventures, and just general chit-chat about how amazing folklore history is and how creative people who once told a story, that story ended up living for thousands of years after, which is just amazing and quite beautiful. It's a very lovely, deep, knowledgeable episode from Amy. She's really passionate about her chosen topic, and it really shines through. That's it from me. I'm just going to hit the play, and I hope next time I speak to you, I'm on the mend. Here we go. Enjoy, witches. Welcome, Amy, to my little podcast. Are you all right?
I'm grand. How are you today?
I'm good. We've been stressing over earphones, but we're on now, so it's all good. Amy is on the podcast. She got in contact with me after a shout out from Facebook, because we're both punky mums, aren't we? The punky family now. When I joined originally, it was punky mums, but it's like a radical punky mums, yeah, from America. And it is a radical parenting group on Facebook, and it is so good. And I've met so many amazing people from it.
I love punky family. I would recommend it. There's folks all over the UK in there.
Yeah, and abroad. I think there's some few abroad as well. For the people before kids that used to be quite gothy and punky and political and get shit done. And now we have babies, but we're still punky.
It helped punky a lot parenting. With remembering who I am.
Yeah.
You lose a lot of your identity when you become a parent. And it's quite you nice do. To reclaim some of that.
No, it's a fabulous group. So it made sense to ask for guests. And Amy said, oh, yeah, I'll do it. And I was like, yay. Can you tell Sounds us fun. A little bit about yourself?
I live in Bristol in the southwest, although I'm originally from Essex, East London kind of area. But I've been here for 12 years, so my accent's sort of neutralised a bit.
Neutralised.
just southern now. I'm folkwitch _ on Instagram, and I focus a lot on folklore and folk tradition in witchcraft. I have a background in archaeology and anthropology. I've did an MPhil a couple of years ago in archaeology and anthropology. And I kind of got into witchcraft that way, which is a bit of a weird way of getting into it, I think, through archaeology and anthropology. I had a nan, a very Cockney nan, who was very big on like folk traditions and stuff. And I saw it as part of my heritage. But looking into archaeology and anthropology, it sort of introduced me to it in other places. And I love how you can still see it today, some of those folk traditions. And I like that you can get archaeological evidence for it as well, like maybe where the ideas came from. So I kind of got into it that way. And then I got into witchcraft that way. And I love it. I love the community. I'm going to a wedding this year of a friend I met on Instagram, and one of her bridesmaids, which is really cool. I love being able to just talk about something I'm passionate about. My day job is for my sins HR at a university, which is awful. So I like having the chance to talk about something I'm passionate about with other people who are also really passionate about it. And becoming a mum was a struggle for me. And I think finding people with similar backgrounds and similar interests who are also parents has helped massively too.
And I've just got to say, your Instagram is so beautiful. You are definitely a photographer as well. You've got such a gorgeous aesthetic on it. It's just like, oh my God.
Thank you. Our old flat, we moved to a new house last year, but our old flat was in like a Georgian building that had really high ceilings and beautiful windows and massive windowsills where I had an altar set up. And I've not quite set anything up here. Yeah, so I'm still trying to get into the groove of it again. I got into taking the photos during lockdown, and it just turned out something I really enjoyed doing, which was nice.
You got such a natural flair for it all, everything like the colours, and it all works really well on the grid.
Thank you. That genuinely means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. Yeah. So, your topic today is
folklore.
Ooh.
But archaeology and folklore. So, I've got a little bit about that. I think I might start with Black Shuck. Black Shuck is the Grim, which I'm sure a lot of you know about. He's a big old black dog who is a bit scary. And if you see him, you might die. I know about it through popular fiction, I guess. There's a lot of black dogs knocking around, lots of Grims. And a lot of folklore is warnings. So Black Shuck would be, don't go near a big dog that you don't know. I feel like there's more to it than that. So I started digging into it. And Black Shuck is, there's variations throughout the UK, which I thought was really cool. Originally, I thought it was just East Anglia, but the version in Bristol is called Girt Dog, which means big dog, which big fan of. And there's a version of the Isle of Man, and there's a version in Scotland, and there's a version of the Channel Islands. And there's a thing in archaeology where we see types of cave art developing all over the world around the same time. So it's sort of like how humans develop at a set rate, even without communication. And part of it feels like maybe that's what happened, but part of it as well must be there must have been a traveller who came over and was like, big black dog, yeah, you're going to die. Don't go near it. And it just sort of developed into folklore. I found out that in 2014, there was an excavation in Suffolk that found a 7 foot tall skeleton of a canine buried in a church graveyard.
Oh my God.
And they've dated it to, I know, right? Terrifying.
It's massive.
It was done by a group called Dig Ventures, who are an archaeological, I would say, community group. So it's a lot of voluntary work. They do a lot of stuff all over the UK. If you're ever interested in doing it, but you've not got any experience, they'd love to have you. They are wonderful people. And they did this excavation, and 7 foot is wild for a dog. And to be buried in a church graveyard is also wild. And it was very much specifically buried there. And it coincides with a pamphlet that was published about Black Shuck, the age of it, from the area. So there's a very good chance that this is where the folk origin came from. There was this big, huge dog that was knocking around the countryside. And everyone was like, God, that's a big dog. Jesus Christ. Don't go near it. You'll die. And that's somehow morphed into, if you see it, you might die soon. It's bad things are coming. And it's kind of slowly gone across the UK. And it all originates from this one dog who was 7 foot tall. And they made a pamphlet being like, careful, it's a dog.
That's mad, isn't it?
So mad. It's amazing, isn't it? That you've, there's a thing, it's in popular fiction. It's been connected to Vikings and the Great Hunt and things like this, the Wild Hunt. And everyone had these ideas, and then actually it was just a dog that was terrorising the town. And something in archaeology is that a lot of the time you find things, and you might find loads of broken pottery in one place, and people are very quick to say it's a ritual, it's an offering. But in reality, it could just be that someone's pottery fell off the back of their cart, and they just, it all broke, so they didn't bother picking it up. And sometimes the simplest everyday answer is the right one.
Yeah.
So instead of it being like, oh, it's about Odin and it's about this mystical wild hunt. No, it's just there was a scary dog and people were trying to warn other people about it. Mm-hmm. And it just kept going from there. And now it's in popular fiction. It's in a book about a boy wizard that I won't go into. It's about loads of stuff like that. And I love it so much. I love that we've had this theory, we've had these stories, and then archaeology swoops in and is like, oh, here's some evidence for it. I love that so much.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. But like you say, we're always looking to put special stories on stuff. I mean, like when I won that sword from Witchfest, and there's loads of stuff about like what it could be, you know, like a ritual sword. I generally think deep in my bones that it was just somebody learning how to make a sword and use the material they had, and were prattling about of it and ended up going in Thames. And they were like, oh, shit, it's got it Thames.
I've lost my sword.
Yeah, I honestly believe that is what's gone on there, you know, because it has ABC in runes on it. I think it's just practicing.
Yeah, you've made me think about runes. I did an archaeological dig in Berkeley in Gloucestershire as part of my uni degree, and they found a stone that had runes engraved in it, and everyone was like, oh, this is amazing. But when you looked into it, they weren't really runes. They were like someone had seen runes. It's a bit like people who get tattoos of Chinese words that they look vaguely of that sort of aesthetic and things, but they're not real. It was a bit like that. Someone was just seeing some runes and gone, yeah, I could do that. Practicing them on stone. And if you didn't know about specific Anglo-Frisian runes are a bit different from the Viking ones, the ones we have in the UK. So if you didn't know about them, you could be like, oh my God, this is a special thing. It's got an inscription. It's really, it was just someone fucking about trying to recreate something. And I like that you see humanity through archaeology. I loved history. I grew up with a mum who adores history as well. And it's her fault entirely that I love history as much as I do. She dragged me to all the museums, partly because they were free and we did not have much money. And growing up near London, we were very lucky with that. But she had her own passion and it instilled it within me. And I loved history and reading about it. But who writes history? It's the people with power, the people who have influence. I'd like to hear about the everyday people, and it led me into archaeology that way. I think it's amazing. There's the everyday stories of people. There's a tile in Bristol Museum that's got a cat footprint on it from the Roman period. And I like to think that there was a guy making tiles and a cat just walked across them and he was like, fuck off. Get out of here. A bloody cat's coming over and ruining all my tiles. And that sort of thing is what makes me love history, because they were people. It wasn't magical. It wasn't, you know, people running through fields and meadows in amazing clothes. It was just everyday people loving, dying, eating, sleeping, just having a bit of fun. And I really love that. I love that so much. And a lot of that comes out in folklore and folk stories. I really like the idea of folk stories being like a lesson for people as well. So again, it's that sort of thing where, oh, it sounds amazing, but really it was just someone telling a kid not to do something. There's Jenny Greenteeth is one of my favourites. She lives in ponds in Lancashire and Cheshire, and she's got green teeth, basically. And some people call her Jenny Longfingers because she's got long fingers. And it was basically a way of saying, kids, don't go near ponds. You'll fall in and all the weeds will grab you and pull you down and you won't be able to get out. But they created a sort of bogeyman of Jenny to say, oh, no, there's a lady living in there. If you go too near it, you'll fall in and she'll grab you and pull you down. And I think it was a way of getting kids to be safe rather than scare them necessarily. I was reading the other day about this, and there was a lady in the 50s who said she could still remember being told about Jenny Greenteeth living in the ponds. And I thought it was amazing how that's lasted. But it's a safety thing. It's don't go near the ponds. You'll fall in and the duckweed, I think it probably is, will drag you down. But kids don't necessarily listen to that sort of thing. So you've got to make an elaborate story for them to actually take heed. And you'll get that everywhere. You get it with the bogeyman. You'll get it with all manner of folklore, with pixies and sprites and elves and trolls when you're crossing bridges. You know, don't talk to people you don't know. I like that with folklore, you get these human aspects of it. It's not like a magical thing. It's most of the time it is just someone warning the child, warning someone they love to be careful, but doing it in a really creative, magical way.
Yeah, it gives it power, doesn't it? Because it's like above everyday stories, you know, it's like an extra element of mystery. And so it probably works better as a warning than just saying, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do it. All right. And they'll fall in. As kids are wont to do. I like the idea that this person's imagination is what has survived for centuries. A story that someone made up is what survived for centuries. And you're not going to get that from the everyday person in archaeology, because archaeology is the history of human stuff, essentially. And history is written, but it doesn't necessarily record things like that. So folklore and folk tales are the remnants of people's imagination. It's the history of people's imagination and creativity. And that's cool. That's the part of humanity that I absolutely adore. And I think that it's great that we get these echoes of that still. There's all these things that loads of us still do where you've got no idea where they've come from. My mum came to visit and she was like, did you put eggs in the recycling without crushing them? And I was like, yeah. She was like, no, you've got to crush them because it's a folklore that witches will ride in on the eggs. And my mum didn't even think, oh, the witches will come. It's just a knee-jerk reaction to doing it. Or people who throw salt over their shoulder, over their left shoulder. That's a folk thing. That's a folklore thing. But most people don't know why they're doing it. They just chuck it over. You could do the more classic examples of black cats and not walking under ladders. It's all these things we do as like a knee-jerk reaction that have permeated our culture and our society. And most of the time, we've got no idea where they've come from. But it's because someone at some point has made up this story. Mm-hmm. And it's so ingrained now that we don't even question it. It's just there. When you start realizing what you do. So I flip a match in the matchbox. I flip the first match and I don't use it until the end. Don't know why. No idea why I do that. I used to do it with cigarettes when I smoked as well. I'd flip a cigarette in the pack. Don't know why I do it. I've tried looking into it. No idea why. But it's obviously something I've picked up from somewhere. And that's probably a folk thing. It's probably a luck thing somewhere along the line. And someone made it up once. And here I am today doing it. No idea why.
I know, yeah, because you did a post on it, didn't you? I've not heard of the match one before. I mean, there's so many I do that I would never not do because it's just not worth the risk, whatever that even means. If you go under ladders, you might get paint on your head. That's pretty obvious. I remember I told you mine was I never do laundry on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And I don't know where that has come from. Perhaps my mum were the same, but it's like you'll wash away your good luck if you do. If you do washing on New Year's Day, it's just like, what? Where does that even come from? But I'll never, do washing. Never.
I listened to a podcast called Betwixt the Sheets by Kate Lister, and it had Ronald Hutton, Ronald Hutton.
Legend, yeah.
I've met him a couple of times because he lectures at Bristol Uni, where I did my degree, and I feel very lucky to have met him. He's as lovely in person as you would imagine. And he was on there talking about pagan rituals and holidays, and he was saying at New Year, he makes a point, he leaves the house around the back and comes around the front and makes sure he's the first one to enter with gifts, because that's a tradition and a folk tradition that he follows. And I thought, never heard of that one before, but when I looked into it, loads of people do it. And it's a bit like not doing your washing. Don't question it, you just do it. I like wishbones are a good one, people breaking them together and doing good luck. No idea where that comes from, but it's something loads of people do. Things like putting a sixpence in a Christmas pudding, which I know my family still do. And it's still a sixpence, which makes me query how old that coin is and how hygienic that is. But
that's impressive.
There's all these things. It is. But then my family we all like history and we all collect stuff that we shouldn't. We're hoarders, but make it aesthetic. My mum puts a pin in a cushion to help remember something. No idea where that's come from, but she does it and she swears it works. People put in knots in handkerchiefs to remember things. These are common stuff that people do, and it's folklore. And at some point in time, someone has created that or adapted it, and it's just sort of kept going and kept going. It's just become part of our lives. And imagine if you could go back in time and say to that person, what you've just done, people are still doing it in 2024. They'd be like, wild. Such a small thing though, like, why? It's just, I find that so magical. That is magical to me.
I mean, and I use wishbones in magic, like gratitude magic and manifesting. I always keep my wishbones and wash them with the washing up and then put them in spell jars and stuff.
I do it too. I use eggshells on a lot of mine. Take the weird film off and dry them out and crush them up. They're also really good for plants, so that's quite a nice way of doing it. Really good fertilizer for plants. There's a good chance that maybe it came from that too. It could have come that it was good fertilizer, so it got used that way. No idea, but I love it. I think sometimes you don't need to know why. I think sometimes it's just nice to appreciate something for what it is, and I kind of love that. But at the same time, I'm really nosy, and I've got ADHD, which you can probably tell by how much I'm talking. So I hyperfocus. So there's a good chance that I'll come off here and go and look it up for about 3 hours until I find the answer.
Hi, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Jess. We're the hosts of the Wicked Wanderings podcast.
Join us every Wednesday as we explore the mysteries of true crime,
the paranormal,
and all things creepy.
We'll take you on a journey through well-known cases
and stories off the beaten path that are sure to leave an impression.
So stay curious,
keep exploring, And always remember to keep on wandering.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So who else are you going to tell us about? Did you have another folklore character?
Something that really bothers me is that Bristol doesn't have a lot of folklore. I've got family. One granddad was from the Lake District. One was from Wales. One was from Ironbridge Way. And one of them was from East London. So there's loads of folklore coming up around that. And I think that's fantastic. But Bristol doesn't really have much. I moved here when I was 18, 30 now. Really hard to get hold of any. And a lot of that is because Bristol doesn't have its own county. Bristol is a city and the county of Bristol. It used to be part of Avon. It was South Gloucester. It's kind of the boundaries have moved a lot. So it's always sort of been its own little island. And trying to find folklore about Bristol has just been bloody annoying. But I like learning about where I'm from. And I like knowing what came before me, because there's a sort of reverence if you know the landscape and you know what was here before. And I think I have a few gripes with stuff to do with ancestors, because not all ancestors are worth celebrating. I live in Bristol. We had Colston. We had the statue come down. Not worth celebrating that man at all. No slave owner is. So some of the ancestry I'm happy to leave behind. But other stuff, like the people who built the area and the people who created what it is today, I want to learn about. And folklore is how I do that. The one that I really like is about the two giant brothers. So Bristol has a huge, it has the River Avon going through it. We've got Bristol Suspension Bridge, which is what, if people hear about Bristol, the main thing that comes up. And it's got this massive, like almost canyon. And the idea is it was built by two brothers who were giants. And it's because they fell in love with someone. And she said, whoever digs this out can have me. And they were like, yeah, all right, game, sounds lush. So they went and dug it out. And they were throwing rocks behind them. And you get all of these standing stones throughout Bristol. And a lot of them are said to have come from them throwing the rocks.
Yeah.
We're not that far from Stonehenge. Like, it makes sense that people saw that and went, oh, how did that get there? Probably someone, a giant throwing a rock. Yeah, that makes sense. And one of the rocks misfired and one of the giants killed his brother with the rock that he threw. And there's an island in the channel between Bristol and Wales, which is said to be the other giant where he died, which is quite far from the gorge. So I'm not quite sure how that makes sense. But I love this story because it's how people in the past used what knowledge they had to explain the natural surroundings. So there's a massive gorge. Don't really know about erosion and, you know, ice melting and things. So how was that? How did that happen? Oh, giants? Yeah, probably. And they've got all these standing stones and, oh, maybe the giants threw those rocks. And they've got this massive island that kind of looks like a shoulder of someone lying down. A bit reminiscent of Moana.
Yeah.
The island at the end that's a goddess. And it's a similar sort of thing. So there's this island in the middle. Where did that come from? It's a giant. That is a physical giant. It's how people interpreted the world around them with what they had. And you can think about all those deities out there who were about lightning and represented lightning. People didn't have an explanation for lightning at the time, so they used what skills and knowledge they had and connected it with a deity. And I think a bit like how folklore is creativity, stories like this are how people just made sense of the world around them. And it's something that a lot of people look back and say, that's really stupid. Of course it wasn't done by giants. But the knowledge that people had wasn't as far flung as we have now. To the best of their knowledge, this explained it. And people want to explain natural phenomena. They want to understand why things happen. So that's how they made sense of it. And I really love that. There's so many instances of stuff like this around the world where people like Thor, it makes sense with the lightning. You'll have stories about, if you look at Persephone and how summer turns to winter, it was people explaining how that happens through a deity, because that's the capacity they had to do it. That's the knowledge they had at the time. It really bothers me when people think that people in the past were stupid, which is not a word I like to use, or just unintelligent, because you can't really compare to today at all. And I think that's incredibly unfair. And we wouldn't be where we are today with technology and everything if people didn't create stuff. So they had to have had some intelligence. And they often did. I mean, look at all the art and wonderful things around the world that people created. It's people using the intelligence, the knowledge they have, the experience they have to explain the world around them. And I love that. I absolutely love that. It's another part of humanity that you get to understand through stories. And it's, again, something that you can't see in the written record or the physical record. So it has to come through folk stories and beliefs and things. Also magical.
Oh, it's quite beautiful, really, that people thought and believed and explained stuff this way. And I kind of think it's a shame that we've lost that mysticism. Can we say it? Mysticism.
Yeah, I think ghosts are our last sort of vestige of that. There's so little in the way of magic in the world now. My view of magic is that less deity-driven and more sort of, this crystal was made under very specific natural circumstances, isn't that magical? To me, the natural world is magical and humanity is magical and our creativity is magical. And I stand in wonder and awe in front of nature. I think it's beautiful. And I think with the leaps and bounds that we make with science and technology, it's quite easy to lose that magic. And I think ghosts are pretty much the last thing that we've got left there, because I've no idea where I stand on that. And I'm happy to have no idea. I think it's great fun to not know, no idea whatsoever about something. It's great. I love being open to new things and magic and something that's unexplainable. But a lot of people don't have that. And I think we lose a lot if there's no magic in our lives. I think sometimes it's nice to have something you can't explain. I think we always need to understand where things come from as humans. But sometimes it's just nice to not have to. It's nice to
wonder. Beauty and wondering, isn't there? And I often say it, life before Facebook, you know, when you think of somebody from your past and go like, oh, I wonder how they are. And
wonder what they're up to.
Yeah. You end up making, you know, this fantasy life for them. And I used to do that a lot as a young person. Now it's like you just look for them on Facebook and you get your answer. It's like, oh.
See, annoyingly, most people my age have deleted their Facebook, so I've gone back to making up a fantasy story in my head.
I'm kind of jealous of that.
Far too nosy. I've had Facebook since I think I was 13. And that's, I now use it just to look at the local stuff about the estate I live on, because that's the sort of person I am now. This is what happens when you get older. You become interested in neighbourhood stuff and bins.
Well, are you 30?
Yeah. I think this community is something I absolutely love. And it's something I've, as a renter, I never had. So now that I've got a community, because I bought a house, which is something I never thought would happen. I just really want to be involved with it. I'm a firm believer if everyone gets looked after, no one gets left behind. With the way that the world is, it's hard to help in the grand scheme of things, but if you can make a difference in your local area. And I think that's why knowing about your local area and how it came to be and how it developed and the people who were there before you is so important, because it makes you connect with it and care for it more. I used to work for a charity, and telling people where the money went made people care more, because they understood the importance of it and the importance of where that money's going. And now it's, for me, folklore and the natural history and stuff is important because it makes you care more. It makes you want to protect it and look after it. And I think the same goes with community too. I'm a big fan of radically caring for other people, just radical care. Above everything else, look after each other.
Yeah, that's why you're a punky, you see. That's what punkies do.
Very much so.
So do you actually like dig up bones and stuff? Do you?
I've never been that lucky. My archaeological stuff now kind of is voluntary. Archaeology is really poorly paid, considering the fact you need a degree for it. It's most of it is on short-term contracts, so there's nothing in the way of maternity or sick pay or holiday pay. And you have to live on site for a long time. So if you have a family, no chance. So a lot of people sort of move out of it quite quickly. I do more voluntary stuff now. So for the last few years, I've been working in rural southern Albania. I can't explain how I got there, I'll be honest. Absolutely no idea. I've got a friend who was doing something there, knew someone from UNESCO who was interested in something. It developed. And this mate knows that I've got a background in community engagement in archaeology. So I think that archaeology belongs to people. It doesn't belong to someone. It belongs to everyone, because it's our collective heritage and history. And I'm a big fan of making sure it's accessible and turning scientific journal articles into something that's easily accessible for people. I think that's important too. So I ended up working there, and Albania was under communist rule for a very long time. It was collectivization. It was forced labour. A lot of people were killed because they spoke up against the state. And it was only in the 90s that it stopped. So there was like a power vacuum. There was a massive financial crisis. Throughout the landscape, there were these huge, huge concrete statues that are really communist, but they're like for people who died in the Second World War. And when the Nazis invaded Albania, they used guerrilla warfare to get rid of them. So you have stories of the little old ladies who ran out of bullets, so they bombed the Nazis on the head with the back of the gun instead. Like, it was very much a community collective effort to get rid of them. And I wrote my MPhil, my research master's, on the perspective of these sort of buildings and things and how the history of them makes people view them differently. So I think a little bit like the Colston statue in Bristol, if it's just a statue of a man who did some charity work, you're like, oh, cool. But the fact is, he bought and sold slaves. So your perspective of that statue is completely changed. When you find out it was only erected in the Victorian period, it changes even more. It's actually relatively new. So people saw these, and during the communist period, it was brutal. People lost loved ones. They lost families. Whole families were wiped out from it. People starved. They know a lot about the food in the local area that grows in the mountains because they had to go and forage for it. So ethnobotany, so like the understanding of medicine and things from plants and the food of plants, is something that's right there and still in use because it was needed up until the 90s. I was saying, like, how do you come to terms with these massive communist statues, knowing what they represent? And they went, it's a phrase that I actually named my thesis, which was the dead don't choose their own tombs. Mm-hmm. So these people who fought for the Second World War and died and were seen as martyrs, they didn't choose to be buried under a communist flag. So they choose to see it as representing the people who passed away for their country, not as a communist thing. They just completely phase that part out. They've changed how they view it based on their current feelings and emotions. And a lot of their folklore and folk traditions changed too. They changed to emphasize brotherhood over national interest. And I thought that was fascinating. So I did work up there, and they have Greek and Roman stuff because it used to be part of the Greek Empire. It was part of Epirus. Alexander the Great's mum is meant to be from that area. And I did a lot of work with the local community because it's very important. It's their history and their heritage, and they should choose how people see it and how people interpret it. I'm a British girl coming over. It's not my place or my right to explain how people should view their own history and heritage. So a lot of my stuff is voluntary, but quite full on. It's why I talked about Dig Ventures earlier, because they're a massive, fantastic group who do a lot of voluntary stuff, and I'm a massive fan. And next weekend, I've got an archaeology summit with all my archaeology mates, and we're going to go and decide who we're helping out next. That sounds really up ourselves, but I've got some fantastic archaeologists in my friendship group. So
he's so brilliant.
It does. I'm not. I would say I just hyper-focus on it. I love history and I love heritage and I love seeing how it impacts today. So people say, what's the point? It's heritage and the arts are massively underfunded in this country, and it has a knock-on effect. People care when they understand. If you take that away, people don't care as much. Having a sense of identity is important, and you find that through heritage and through the landscape. And you take that away, it's difficult. I'll try not to make it too political.
Life's political, isn't it? It's hard not to.
Everything is political. If you say
absolutely
you have no interest in politics because it doesn't affect you, you're wrong. You're wrong.
Yeah.
Or very privileged. So, but I've written a lot of freelance stuff about this. I'm going to segue now into
good
into something. I've written a lot of freelance articles and things for magazines about witch marks, which are engraved into buildings in like the 16th or 18th, sometimes 19th century, which were meant to be apotropaic, which I think I've said that right, which means protection marks. So you'll see them in a lot of old buildings. They're daisy wheels, so they're like a daisy with a circle around, or mesh marks, or a W sign. And I've written about those. And a publisher got in touch with me after reading one and offered me a book deal. So I'm currently
wow.
in the middle. Well, actually, no, I'm not in the middle. I'm towards the end of writing a book now about occult symbols and runes and stuff. So I get to draw on my experience in archaeology. And I'm really excited. It's being published through Leaping Hare, which is under Quarto, and they have a book out called Practical Crystals, so it will be a sister book to that called Practical Symbols. I'm so excited. I've always wanted to be an author and write about stuff, and one of the selling points, I guess, is that something that bothers me a lot is things being shared on the internet that have absolutely no fact behind them, and people take it as truth. it's a thing that's a problem throughout the world. Things like women don't have pockets because they thought we'd hide witchy stuff in them. There is nothing out there that says that's true. It's all over, I'm going to age myself by saying this, Tumblr. It's all over Instagram. I assume it's all over TikTok. I don't go on TikTok because I know I'd waste my life on it. It's everywhere. And it really bothers me because it's not true. And there's nothing there to support it. And I read books that have absolutely no founding in what they're writing at all. And people take it as truth. Research skills are not a thing that's necessarily taught in schools. I did history, philosophy, and ethics and art at A level, and I was not taught research skills, which is wild. And it wasn't until uni that I really understood it. So people aren't necessarily going to fact check. They're not going to necessarily look at primary and secondary sources or have access to things. And academic texts are long and boring for quite a lot of it. I've been attempting to make this book have factual stuff popped into it. So archaeological evidence, references to archaeological sites that have these symbols. There's like 280 of them, so not all of them have it. But I've made like a conscious effort to be like, no, this is grounded in fact. And I've got a section that encourages people to go and do their research around things, even the stuff in my book. I want people to question it. I think that a lot of the power from symbols comes from their use over centuries. So the Degas, I'm saying it wrong and I know I am, rune, is the one that's like a butterfly. It's two triangles pointed towards each other. And it's been in use for so long. It means day, I think. And it was an Anglo-Frisian, so Anglo-Saxon rune, and it was an Elder Futhark, so it was a Viking rune. And then it was turned into a witch mark because it was believed to shine light in dark places so that no evil spirits and stuff could hide there. You've seen people use this symbol for this reason for centuries and centuries. So when you use it, you're not just using a symbol. You're using something that has power built and built and built by hundreds of thousands of people over that time. So it's important to know the heritage of it. And one of the issues I've had with this book is I see a symbol, I think it's awesome, and oh look, it's used by Nazis, it's used by white supremacists, look, it's a fash. It's a constant issue that I've been running into, and I think it's important to know that too. You need to know if this symbol is being used by a hate group, and you need to do your research into that. Because it might not affect you, but it might affect someone else. And if you believe in positive energies and things, if you're using a symbol that's used by such a negative group, do you really think that's going to benefit you in any way? Do you think it's really the right course of action to be using? And I'm all for reclaiming things, but you need to have a time and a place and a community that's big enough to do that. Doing it by yourself is not necessarily going to make a difference. And I've got a section in the book about that as well, about symbols that have been co-opted. There's an awful lot of them that were used by the SS and things like that. They were really into the occult, the SS, if anyone ever has interest in that. Really recommend looking into it because it is wild how into the occult they were. But it means that they've co-opted all these symbols and awesome stuff. And I personally wouldn't want to use them. So I've had to like leave out certain symbols that I cannot in good faith use them. But I want people to look them up. I want people to say, oh, actually, maybe I shouldn't use that in my own work because it's literally a hate group. Literally Nazis use this. So I want people to read it and question it and look it up and develop their own research skills and question things and understand the symbols and where they've come from so that they can understand the power behind them and understand they can be used for not just, so Degas was just day, it meant day, but it can mean other things. So I want to see how people are doing that too and how they're using symbols for different stuff or creating their own. Some of the symbols I have in there are neo-pagan, so they're only a decade old. Just as important, just as valid. Creativity is important too.
Oh, I'm so excited that you've told us about your book. So is it an exclusive then that you've told us about this book?
I've been hinting it. I've got a cover, but it's like a draft cover. So I was waiting for the proper cover to come out before I could post about it. I'm really lucky because the person who's illustrating it is Vicky Lester of Forensic and Flowers. And I actually used to subscribe to her Patreon because I love her so much. So when they suggested her, I was like, oh my God, yes. So I've no idea when it's going to be published. No idea. Final draft is handed in 3 weeks' time. So I'm still writing it, but it's been a dream come true. I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to do stuff to do with archaeology and heritage and things like that. And I'm so excited to be writing this. I'm so excited.
That's amazing. Congratulations. That is so huge. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Do you have a witch business then? Do you do, like, are you a professional witch?
No, not at all. This is purely for my enjoyment. People have reached out about stuff like that. I find it really hard to monetize things that I enjoy doing. So I'm a big crocheter. I like crochet. I'm a big crafter. I find that I lose enjoyment when I end up turning it into like money. I see it as a passion. I would love to write about it. I'm all for that. But I think I always wanted to wait until it was something that I really adored, that I could like really put my whole self behind. I guess it impacts my academic career as well as, you know, my witchy one. So I have to be a bit more like on it about stuff like that. But no, I've got someone who has an MLM who regularly contacts me trying to make me turn it into a business. But other than that, no.
That old chestnut. Thank you for coming on to the Bell Witch podcast. Where can we find you? What's your Instagram handle again?
You can find me at folkwitch_. I also have a website that's linked on my Instagram. It hasn't been updated in a really long time because I had a child. But there are some old blog posts on there about folklore and witches that you can have a look at. I'm hoping to keep adding to it now that I've got into the swing of writing again, but we'll see. But at the moment, I post on Instagram mainly stories because it's nice and quick, but I do post there quite regularly and share stuff. And I will be posting about the book as soon as I get a new cover. I'm very excited to share it.
I know, I'm so excited for you.
And I've put you on the list of people to send a book to as well. So you will be getting one from the publisher when it's published.
Perks of the job.
It is, isn't it? I love getting free books. It's the best.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun. And thank you for enduring my terrible headphone problems.
It's fine, don't worry about it. It's great. You have been listening to the Bell Witch podcast, Witching in the 21st Century. Written and produced by me, Swales, a Friendly Green Witch. Official podcast photographer is Beverly Thornton. Music by Jeff Harvey of Pixabay. Made on WavePad Master and distributed via Zencaster. Want to come and guest on the show or got a topic you'd like me to cover? Email me at thebellwitchpodcast@yahoo.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave me a review. Thank you for listening and stay magical, witches!